Dear Salish Sea, I wonder what you would think of us now. How we walk with our lips closed as tightly as the oysters you carry.
In March 2024, we were joined at the studio by Mateo Acuña and Amina Muggle for a conversation about Mateo's experience as the 2023-24 Seattle Youth Poet Laureate, and for a reading from Mateo's forthcoming chapbook through Poetry Northwest Editions, Dear Spanish. Amina and Mateo are both members of SAL's Youth Poetry Fellowship Program. Mateo Acuña is a Peruvian-American poet, writer, and visual artist who splits his time between Auburn and Seattle, Washington. He is the 2023-24 Seattle Youth Poet Laureate and the 2024-26 Auburn Poet Laureate, a spokes intern at Youth Speaks, a member of the Washington Arts Youth Leadership Cohort, and a librettist in the Seattle Opera Creation Lab. His and composer Mina Pariseau's opera, Blood Dawn of the Inti Sun, will premiere at Tagney Jones Hall in June 2024. He also sells jewelry made from repurposed and recycled materials. Amina Muggle is a teen editor at Teen Ticks, a bookseller, and a senior at Eastside Prep. Her previous work can be read in publications like Blue Marble Review, and as the runner-up for the Patricia Grodd Poetry Prize, her work is forthcoming in the Kenyon Review. She is a lover of Taylor Swift and her hometown. I'm Indira Dahlstrom, the Youth Programs Associate at Seattle Arts and Lectures. You're listening to SAL On Air, a collection of talks from the world's best writers from 36 years of Seattle Arts and Lectures, including this special showcase from our Youth Poetry Fellowship program. The Youth Poetry Fellowship serves a cohort of young writers committed to poetry, performance, civic and community engagement, education, and equity across the Puget Sound region. Now we'll hear a few poems from Dear Spanish. This is SAL On Air.
My testimony. I don't remember how or when I was gifted $10, a rare occurrence for me growing up. But come Sunday, my parents made me give 10% of it as tithing to the Mormon church, the way my father did his wages, the way everyone in church did their income. The blow was devastating. The blow was $1. I had planned on buying two LPS, or littlest pet shops, bug-eyed animal bobbleheads that could fit in the palm of my hand. They were exactly $5 each and collected by little girls everywhere. My friends always had more of them than I did. Now my dollar went not to a second LPS, but to the LDS, a very different kind of cult. Now my dollar funded a mall in Utah or a priest's Ferrari. At 8, I was baptized jacuzzi style, leaving the sins I presumably had with my 7-year-old self, making room for the many more to come. After I changed out of the heavy white robe and dried off, the priest had me join the audience, which felt wrong, since I thought I was the star. The chairs were metal, collapsible, the color of dust, LDS, spray-painted in white block militaristic letters as if they had been tagged by a gang of religious zealots. The priest stood at the head of the room behind a podium and said a prayer. I opened my eyes in the middle of it and looked around. Surely, if I were to see him, it would be now. Jesus was ruggedly handsome, with flowing auburn hair, a full luscious beard, mirror gray eyes, and pale pink skin, according to the famous Mormon portrait. If mortal eyes were too weak to see him in his full hunk form, I was told he would appear like a mass of light. Alas, Jesus was a no-show. Still, I believed in him like I did the ghost of the old woman who died decades ago in our house, who my father saw as a shadow on the wall crossing his room at night, who I saw as a middle-aged woman watching me in the corner of the kitchen in the corner of my eye, disappearing whenever I looked directly. Artist's bracket. When I cut my hair, I smash a record, fracture a song, rip pages from a calendar, chop down a tree, and leave a stump. When I cut my hair, I need 3 mirrors, one in front of me, one behind me, and one beside me. As the minutes stretch into hours, I become trapped in mirrors, learn to move in its realm, inverse. Up is down, right is left, forward is backward. I bring the whirring blades around my ears that grow like shelf fungi. Once I used a 12-foot-tall fallen sapling to knock down a hefty piece of artist bracket that grew like a frog's pouch mouth on the side of an evergreen. Dopamine hit when it fell. It fogged up the sandwich bag with its breath like a kid huffing at a winter window. It sat on my kitchen island for days before I threw it away, a destructive, useless conquest. A surgeon cut out my uterus and threw it away. I never saw that hockey puck of an organ I had growing inside me. If it were mine, I would have dressed it in the long strands of hair I snipped and given my father the girl he wanted. Dear Salish Sea, I wonder what you would think of us now, how we walk with our lips closed as tightly as the oysters you carry, how we blow smoke that turns your reflection to steel. We have learned coldness from your waters, have turned away from you as a source of strength. You gladly swallow our bottle caps and plastic wraps, then lay them at our feet like humble offerings, asking us to change. You used to be seen on a miles-long shore near my home. That shore has been reduced to a sanctioned square behind a chain-link fence downtown, hidden behind dizzying skyscrapers that cut the land like teeth through the gum. You used to float otters. Now all you float is aimless driftwood I turn into deconstructed dream catchers. Like your receding shore, traditional knowledge of the craft left me behind in the hourglass of time. But in you, I see the tenacity and resilience of my Chippewa foremothers showing me what it means to adapt. Your presence is hope, a love letter to the future. La cosa con plumas. When I started calling myself a man, at first I thought teak wood, tobacco, mahogany, whiskey, ash, and smoke. Before I found me, in my soft-petaled citrus, cinnamon and pastels, fuchsia and leather heels, la cosa con plumas.
Now we'll hear a conversation between Mateo and Amina.
Hi, Mateo. Thank you so much for being here. So I do have a few questions about your chapbook and how you have become a writer and your journey up until this point. Are you ready to just jump into it?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm ready.
So I just wanted to start at the beginning and ask, how did you start writing and how did you like become a poet specifically as well?
That's a good question. I always wrote as a kid, not poetry, just short fiction, little stories. I would illustrate them too. And then as I got older, I, you know, tossed out the illustrations and would just have like chapbooks. I guess they're more like novellas really because they were shorter. I would call them my books. And then I started writing poetry a couple years ago through a college class that I took. I was at Pacific Lutheran University at the time. It was with Rick Barrett. Anytime someone asks me about my poetry journey, I always have to mention him because he was really influential. Like, I really connected with his teaching style, and I think that's why I continued with poetry, really. Like, that was the gateway. So we had an intro to creative writing class. So there were three units. First was poetry, then creative nonfiction, and then lastly fiction. And I was the worst in poetry. I was. And I knew that I was, and I could tell that what I wanted in my head wasn't what was coming out on the paper. Mm-hmm. But I guess I'm kind of a sadist because I just pushed for that. I thought I wanted to, you know, round out my skills as a writer. So, and then I also really liked his teaching style, and he is a poet. And so he teaches a intermediate poetry class. And so I took that, and with the poems that I wrote in that class, mostly from that class, I think, is what I used to apply for the Seattle Youth Poet Laureate.
Wow.
So it's all been fairly recent.
Yeah. So did you find that poetry offered, like, something specific to you as a medium that maybe you didn't get in fiction?
Beginning, middle, end. Like with fiction, I was working on a book for 5 years mm-hmm. and it was going nowhere. I would think, oh, you know, I'm so close to the end, but then things would get all jumbled up. I would change my mind or think it's just not. I was just like editing things, something that I had written like many years ago. Mm-hmm. And so what I liked about poetry is that I could have a finished product at the end of the day. It might not be perfect. Yeah, I might have to revisit it, but I have like a whole thing that I could show someone without having to give them 20 minutes of exposition and how the world building is working and all that. So it was just really refreshing as a writer to be able to write about other things.
And, yeah, it's very freeing.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's how, and then I just fell in love with it, really. I didn't stop.
So with how recently you've come to poetry, what was your mindset like going into writing like a full-length chapbook?
Well, I've never read a chapbook. I'm going to be like entirely honest. I've read collections mm-hmm. since then. I read part of a chapbook. So I kind of relied on my mentors to kind of tell me, you know, it doesn't have to be cohesive in the sense that there's a narrative through line, even though that did kind of end up happening. But I began thinking of it as like a mixtape, like Garfield was just saying. He was with us in the other room before and we were talking about that. It's, you know, just a handful of poems that I wrote and that's kind of how I went about it, really. Yeah. And also, I didn't want poems that stuck out too much from the others, you know, thematically, which was fine for the most part because I was mostly writing in a certain area. Once I got the Seattle Youth Poet Laureate, I knew that there was going to be the book deal. So that's when I kind of made the choice, okay, I'm going to focus on identity, gender, that kind of religion, culture, heritage. And so that's kind of how it came together.
So you kind of knew that was the direction you were going to go in when you started?
Yeah. Well, when I applied, when I was preparing to apply, Barrett said, usually with the Youth Poet Laureate, there's a lot of poems about identity. And encouraged me for the application to go from that angle. And I think that's good advice because, you know thyself, right? It's like the most – we're kind of experts in our own selves. And so if there's nowhere to – that's the easiest place for inspiration. And also there's like a growing movement with youth poetry, especially with something that's identity-centered, cultural-centered. So – and I also had just a lot of personal stake in it, too.
What was it like starting to write about identity after you had been in fiction for so long? Because I know, like, it can be kind of, like, daunting or scary to do that amount of self-reflection. And
oh, yeah. Yeah, it felt kind of like journaling. I've had a journal since fourth grade. And there was a point where I was writing almost every day. I still journal quite frequently. Maybe a few times a week. Now it's become an outlet to let things out, as it always has been, but also with, I don't know, finding more joy in life or just pointing out things or observations. But because I had the journaling as a background in some way, once I kind of found my way to the identity writing and poetry, started flowing like really quickly just because that was kind of already happening in my conscious. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really cool to hear. And about like going into writing this chapbook, in earlier conversations, I know we've discussed like how difficult it is to write when you know you're going to be, when you know your writing is going to be seen. And obviously identity writing is really personal. So I was just wondering, like, did you have like a like fear about that? And how did you deal with it when you were writing the chapbook?
Well, one thing I'm scared of is to fall into stereotypes. But as Joy Harjo says, or she said, she recently came to Sal, and I was there, and you were there. We saw that, or I don't remember if she said it there, but somewhere she said, you know, to the stereotypes, just ignore them. And that was really powerful. You know, I think, so that had, you know, scared me initially, but, you know, part of that is to confront that fear too. Especially because, you know, I don't want to be tokenized. And that's a fear as well. But the nuance that poetry can provide is what makes it complex and what can move it away from being a stereotype or a trope into a nuanced, living, breathing thing. So going into that was helpful for me. And, you know, at one point I just stopped thinking about, oh, everyone's going to read this or whatnot, or will this be in the chapbook or will this not be, you know?
Yeah.
Because every time you sit down to write a poem, if you know you have a book coming out, it's like, is this going to be in the book? But I just, I don't know, at one point I kind of just stopped thinking about that.
Awesome. So you mentioned Joy Harjo and a couple of, like, your mentors. Are there any other poets that have really, like, influenced you, or writers in general that you can think of?
Yeah, so Victoria Chang is a huge influence. She was introduced to me through Rick Barrett, who's her friend. They're, like, besties, and I love that for them. Yeah, so introduced me to her work, and, you know, I really resonated with it. It's so sharp and so much unexpected imagery. It's almost like half dream, half lucidity, but it comes together with such clarity that, I mean, especially, you know, Obit, Dear Memory, which is creative nonfiction hybrid poetry, but it kind of defies any category, really. It's epistolary form. Mm-hmm. And that's where the title Dear Spanish came from. It's a nod to that collection because I had taken that book with me on a band trip to Ireland for 2 weeks. It was the only book I brought with me. And we were, for hours, we were in these, you know, tour buses driving around the country. And it's just all, you know, very pretty, but it's just kind of the same green stuff out there and it's long. So I was reading this book. I finished it. I just had nothing to do. So I just kept reading it over and over until I had those poems like all inside me and I was almost sick of it. And then I came back and wrote Dear Spanish in like one sitting. I mean, it's basically unchanged since I first wrote it.
Oh, I love that. I love that like reverential aspect in your, or like referential, I guess is the right word. That's really cool. That's really
well, a little cool. Bit of reverential.
Reverential, too. Referential. Yeah, same thing.
Yeah. And Ada Limón also for the nature stuff. That's something I've been starting to explore more with nature, especially because it's spring. So we're, you know, the weather's starting to change. I love being outside. I just get really cooped up when I'm inside. So I love going out there and starting to bring poetry to that aspect too. So, I mean, I love her work too, and how the animals, or what she often does is she'll take an animal and then that'll be a symbol for her own feelings, or she'll kind of tell these little secrets about herself through the animal, which I think is interesting to be part of nature or to put yourself up against nature to see how humans are similar or different. She explores that a lot, and I really like that.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, she's great. She's so great. So you mentioned that you got that title for the poem Dear Spanish from Dear Memory. So why did you choose that as the title for your whole collection? Is there a specific thing about that poem or Dear Memory that it's from that?
I picked it because I think it's my best poem in there.
<That's fair>.
Honestly, well, and I know that can change over time and evolve, but that was the one that I felt was the strongest and also was the most personal, feeling incomplete or sort of inside and outside of different cultures at the same time was a feeling that I always had growing up. And I talk about other things in the poetry chapbook. I talk about, you know, transness, gender, but I only came out as trans 2 or 3 years ago. I don't know, I think it was 3 years ago now. So relatively recently. So all of those feelings are still fresh and kind of still settling, while the culture thing has always been with me. So that is really like deeply entrenched. So when I wrote Dear Spanish, it was definitely like, I don't know, it sounds cliche to say like a piece of my soul, but it really did feel like it was a poem that had lived in me for a really long time.
I love that. I love the way you said that it had lived in you for a really long time. That's very poetic, of course. And throughout the collection in Dear Spanish, I mean, obviously you have Dear Spanish in both Spanish and English in the collection. And you integrate like Spanish and like native Peruvian words throughout the collection. Is there like a specific mindset you had writing multilingually, or how did you approach that?
That's a really good question. I still think about, you know, I'm still navigating that for myself. And I think in my later works that, you know, are yet to be written, you'll find different approaches. And I think it offers a lot of exciting possibilities when you're mixing two languages, as long as it's not a gimmick. That's the big thing. But so to be genuine about it, of course. And that's the same thing with tokenism as well. But with Dear Spanish, I was writing it in English and Spanish at the same time. So they're side by side because I was writing it in both languages at once. And now, you know, I would like to perform it going back and forth between two. That's something that I really wanted to do. And so, yeah, I was debating actually including the third would be too many, but maybe rather than just English and Spanish, one that's a mix of both or, you know, something like that. But I, in the end, I decided to just keep it one in English, one in Spanish, so that, I don't know, so that if someone's just a Spanish speaker or they prefer that, they can read it in Spanish. And if someone prefers English, they can read it in English. And, you know, maybe that's my own personal kind of self-division, but I'm working to kind of bring it together. Mm-hmm. So when I perform it, I think something that I would like to do is start blending that more. And in the opening poem, The Story of the Scar on My Left Knee, it does mix some Spanish and English. So, but it's hard. It's hard because, you know, there's a couple of poems that didn't end up in the book because of how difficult it was to switch between those languages. Especially as a writer, I feel like, you know, being an English writer or writing in English, it's so, like my vocabulary is probably, I think of language more deeply than just the average person, probably where language is just functional, transactional. And so I have really high expectations of what it means to be fluent in a language because I'm a writer. So with Spanish, it's really hard not to get discouraged because there's so much I don't know. So conversationally, I could be fluent. I could get by, you know, some grammatical errors, but I could hold a conversation. But for me, it's almost like nothing just because I know compared to English, I'm so far behind. So it's weird like that. I think if I was in any other profession or like, like talent or hobby or whatever, it wouldn't feel like this bad. But it's because I'm working with language all the time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as writers, we think about language, like language in general as a concept, more so than the average person.
Yeah.
And I love how the book represents or, like, reflects that kind of internal conflict. That's amazing. Like, to go into, like, a little bit of the specifics of the chapbook, in the middle, you have some, like, erasure poetry. And I wanted to know, like, why did you choose to include it in that format? Like, obviously, they're amazing poems, but, like, having that erasure style.
Well, they were erasure poems.
Okay.
So I wouldn't want to include them without the blackout parts because, I mean, the way you see them in the chapbook is exactly how they are erased on the papers that I do have. It's not stylized in any way or anything. It's very, I mean, genuine to how it happened. And they're kind of near the middle of the chapbook because I wanted to break it up a little bit. Again, to go back to Victoria Chang, in obit in the very middle, she has a very long erasure or erasures. So the idea there is to kind of break up the reader's expectations. It could be kind of like to avoid dullness, I guess. But yeah, so I just think it made sense to put them near the middle and almost kind of mirrors of each other on either side of the book rather than, you know, right next to each other or something. I didn't want to put them too close to the beginning so that people weren't expecting a lot of erasures, or just at the end where it's like, whoa, where did these erasures come from? This wasn't in the whole book. So it just made sense to me to put them there.
Cool. Yeah. It's very interesting to read it and have it be broken up in that way. Yeah. Mm. And so, I don't know, just kind of the vibe that I'm getting from talking to you is that you really like value like being completely genuine in your writing. And I don't know, like having writing that's so confessional, is that like important to you and stylistically and just?
Yeah. With the confessional style with myself, that was very important. I guess it's part of building trust with the reader is like, I don't know. I just think that a lot of times in this day and age, art and things like that, it's like one of the last personal connections that we make with each other. You know, sometimes we can be really distant from one another. We can create our own worlds through technology. It can be isolating. So with art, for me, a big part of it is just feeling connected. So, and to me, I build connection just by being myself, like being genuine. So it just happened like that.
Interesting. And I don't know, when I was reading the collection, I saw this really interesting balance between like the anger that you hold and like empathy and imagery and description. And I just wanted to know, like being, you know, kind of new to the form and going into this chapbook, was there a specific way that you approached like developing your voice, or did you just go for what felt natural? Or
The only thing that I would say that I was trying to develop was the diversity in content. Mm-hmm. And I think that in my later works, you'll find a lot of these sprinkles of, you know, stories, identities, or experiences I've had will probably expand into new poems, new things. So that was what I was really developing, because I had the core of the chapbook all together, you know, The Poet at 17, Meditation on Belonging, Working Men, Dear Spanish, probably another one or two, but all those poems I had written before I started the YPF cohort. And so when I came in, I already had a lot of poems, and my mentor said, because you have so much, you don't necessarily have to work to generate new material, but to refine what you have. So part of it was refining, but I did want to generate new material anyway. But I kind of used those and expanded out. And I didn't really realize I was doing it at the time, but in hindsight, I look back and see that's how I went about it.
Yeah. So I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about like the decision-making process and picking what went in and what, you know, you had to take out, and also like the order, because to me, I don't know, I thought that the order was so like artfully done. I was like, I'm being taken on this journey. Oh my God. Was there like a lot of thought that went into that, or?
Oh, yes. Yes, there was so much thought. I'm glad to hear you say that, because I did, you know, agonize over the order. And part of me was like, it's more about the poems, but then the order is also important. But like, who's going to pay attention to that? But like, it's also everything. And, you know, I printed out all the poems and had them spread out on my dining room table. It's a very long table. And like moving stuff around, shifting, finding threads. And sometimes it's even just a single piece of imagery that is like a hinge to the next poem. Sometimes it's the way it ends. It's kind of similar. There's a lot of imagery with like shadowy figures in the book. Sagrada Familia, Poeta 17, my testimony ends with that that figure of the ghost. So those were kind of in conversation with each other and created a new meaning or symbol out of that figure that's kind of hiding. It's like, what is that? And I hope that the readers will be able to pick up on those symbols that are all throughout the book, and being able to tell the poetic symbol in there across the poems, like what it represents to them.
Yeah, I love that. I was reading, I don't remember what the second poem was called, but it ended with that line about like a renaissance.
Yeah, renaissance.
Blew my mind. Oh my God. I was like, I'm writing this question down right now. I need to know if this was on purpose. And it was wonderful.
What was on purpose?
The like having that line be in the second poem and then just like this explosion right after it. Like it's just beautiful. I love it. So with the taking stuff out and putting stuff in, was there like, were you looking for specific images and trying to make it cohesive? Is that what like the baseline requirement for being in the collection was?
I knew I had poems that I wanted to be in there. And what happens when you're writing in a particular circle or sphere, which was what I was doing, is like you tend to, the same images kind of keep popping up. And so that was a natural thing that was happening. But my job putting it together was to bring that out and in like an artful way, or a way that will draw out the meaning more or make it more obvious so the readers can put it together. Like one thing I tend to do is I'll have a poem and then the ending is almost like a gut punch. and so I wouldn't want, and I, that's something, that's a stylistic thing that I just tend to do. But I wouldn't want that every single time back to back, because then it's like, okay, here's another like plot twist. And then it doesn't become a plot twist anymore. It doesn't become unexpected. So breaking it up in terms of, you know, kind of the techniques that I use, the craft, and then also form-wise. Like I didn't want to start out the book with all my quatrain poems, because then people will expect more quatrains. And then when I have like a single stanza, it's like, what, you know? Mm-hmm. So you let the readers know what to expect, or you teach them how to read your book just in those first few poems.
I love that. Yeah, yeah, you do. And like with that in mind, is there anything specific that you want readers to take away, or do you just want people to experience it like however they're going to? Did you have any like goals in mind thematically?
Yeah, I was thinking I wanted to leave them with hope, even though I struggled to write about, or I struggled. I'm finding that I'm getting better with practice to write about joy or happiness, the good things, because there's not necessarily tension inherent as obviously as when you're writing about sorrow or anger, like something, you know, made you feel that way, or there's a conflict there. So from a story writing perspective, it's easier to jump into that because you've already got that like waiting for you. While with joy, you know, if you just wrote a story about people having a picnic and nothing bad ever happens, it's like, well, that was boring, you know? So, so that was a struggle, but I did want to leave it on a note where acknowledging that even though, you know, Dear Sailor, She's Near the End, for example, and like talking about how it's been affected by the environment. So it's like, even though these things are happening in our world, it's still like a sign of hope, and trying to see that in all, as many situations as you can. Some situations are just bad, but you know what I mean? It's like, because overall, like I am an optimistic person. And I just wanted to push at the end like a little bit of hope or optimism.
I love that. I love that. You mentioned that storytelling aspect, and I don't know, I just thought of this because you had like so much experience, or I guess when you first came to writing, it was through fiction. Do you think that your fiction has like informed the way that you see poetry at all?
Oh, yeah. It's had a huge impact because I write narrative poems.
Yeah.
And that's directly from fiction. So, and now I'm starting to explore like the full realm, I think, the breaking out, but fiction definitely, I mean, I think just if you read my work, the connection is apparent. But in a way, it's interesting because I think while there are these poetic elements that make it a poem. In some ways, having it fiction, having it be kind of from fiction makes it a little bit easier for people to understand that maybe are not necessarily interested in poetry or might find, you know, difficult to parse through and like these crazy leaps of words and it's like, ah, what's going on? So in that way, I hope that maybe some people that don't normally read poetry will be able to understand it. But, you know, at the same time, it's like I try not to be concerned about commercial viability or, you know, that. I mean, I'm a poet. How can I be concerned about that?
Yeah, I love that. And to some extent, right, the lines we draw between fiction and poetry are like arbitrary. At some point, they blur. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Like with The Poet at 17, that's taken from like the horror genre. And I do want to explore that more, like cosmic horror in poetry and like, you know, genre poetry. So yeah, it's absolutely, you know, those lines are just constructs.
Yeah. To that point, is there any like part of the poetry genre or any genre in general you want to explore in the future? Like, what does your writing future look like?
Well, I've done quite a few different things. I wrote a 20-minute opera. It's called Blood Dawn of the Inti Sun, and it's premiering in June. I've written in collaboration with my composer, Amina Pariseau. And so that was a lot like poetry, a lot like narrative poetry, because it was a story, but it's also very poetic or lyrical. And in this case, the music is the imagery or the main symbol. So when you just read it, it almost feels a little bit incomplete without the music. I think that's a good libretto. Mm-hmm. So that I find very natural for me. And also I have a background as a classical musician. So it, that kind of, that marriage was just waiting for me. And I also would like to like start crawling slowly back to fiction eventually, but it's a huge investment, and for me I just want to make sure that the idea and the world and the concept are worth devoting, you know, like 5 years of my life to, because yeah, that just seems like it could be a waste of time. Like, so short fiction writing is what I'd like to start with, and then maybe novellas or novelettes, and then if I have an idea that I feel like it needs to be a book, mm-hmm. or a series or, you know, whatever, then I'll do that. And also creative nonfiction. Yeah. A lot of the times when I was writing this chapbook, I felt like this is kind of a memoir-ish. Like, it's kind of hinging, like, it's slowly becoming that. So I'm like, do I want to do something like Joy Harjo did, where she had a memoir, but there's, that's interspersed with like song lyrics that she wrote or poems that she wrote. And so, yeah, right now I'm just like, I don't know, in a playground with a bunch of words and I'm just making stuff.
And I feel like you pointed out something really important, that our writing is always sort of like becoming something else. Like, I don't know if you feel this way about Dear Spanish, but like a poem is like capturing a specific moment in time, but we're always, you know, moving forward. And I don't know, how, I was just wondering, like, how did YPF and having mentors sort of facilitate, like, your journey coming to a point with Dear Spanish?
It was really nice to have mentors. I think that was really big because I really like feedback. That's how I improve. That's how I get better. I can be critical, very critical of my work and other people's work, too. But I like that. Mm-hmm. As long as it's not, you know, this is garbage, or they weren't like that at all. They were great. And so that really helped, I think, refine and shape what I already had. It was just validating too to have mentors that are saying like, this is a really good poem, because most of the time, you know, I was just writing by myself and then maybe I'd show my partner or something. And then that's it. So it was really nice because it pushed me to share like with the community. As a Seattle Youth Poet Laureate, you know, sometimes you get invited to readings or gigs and things like that. So I got a lot of practice performing my poetry. I was a struggle bus, like in the beginning. Like I read, and I think it was at one after one of the events, my partner was like, can I give you some feedback on your reading? And I was like, no. And then the next day I was like, okay, you can tell me. And it was basically that I was going monotone, you know? And so then I learned how to like tap into my, you know, middle school theater kid era.
Yeah.
But also like to tap back into those emotions. So the it really helped me with performance.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, when I went in, I wasn't thinking like, oh, I want to be a better performer.
So what was it like entering this community space with YPF and with like the greater Seattle poetry scene?
It was so beautiful. I got to hear some amazing poets. I felt like I started to learn more about the other poets in Seattle. And also just like opportunities that Seattle has that I didn't know about. You know, when you start reading like bios of other authors, you start seeing like the same sort of residencies or things that they've done in the region. So then it's like, oh, okay, you know, maybe I should check this out like for the future. Or it's almost like laying down the milestones for you to go towards. So it helped me kind of not only with my goals, which is to be like a writer full time, that would be like my dream, mm-hmm. In whatever kind of writing, but also like how to get there. It's like those things have been laid out so I can see what it takes rather than just having to dream and be like, oh, I don't know how I'll get there. You know, it's just some impossible, like far out thing.
Oh. Yeah, it's so like crazy revolutionary to have like role models when you're a writer, because writing like feels like a solitary thing, but it's like it's not. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, community is a big part of it. And I was just, I wanted to get a little bit of your insight about like arts access and arts programs and what you kind of have learned or already thought about arts education.
Yeah. So I moved up here to Seattle in the fall. And when I moved up here, I realized how much arts education Seattle has. And, you know, it could be better, you know, but compared to Auburn, where I grew up, where it was like, I don't know. Poetry didn't have much appeal for me because we were just kind of, I don't know, poetry always rhymed and was like sing-songy, and it wasn't necessarily like what I wanted to do because I wanted to write like serious stuff. So it really opened my eyes up like moving here and then also being part of this program and just talking to other young writers and like even the fact that like you know what poetry is, like on the same, like having read the same writers, like how old are you?
18,
yeah. It's like when I was 18, I don't know how much I really knew. Like you're already like deeper into that world of stuff than like I was. And I think it's probably because of a good arts education in the schools. Like they have writers in the schools. They have all this kind of stuff. That's just like giving young people resources. And you know, that's why, I mean, if I was a little bit younger, I could apply to be the regional youth poet laureate, and then that turns into like a national thing. But because, coulda, woulda, shoulda, but like if I had been exposed to poetry and like someone had kind of sparked that passion in me or exposed me to it, then, you know, maybe I could have had that sooner and then I would be eligible to qualify for regionals, for example. But there are other opportunities. But that's just like one thing that it's like, that's why it's important to have arts education. Because it's an escape for some people. They just want to write about or paint or music or whatever their cup of tea is. That's just good for like the soul, like for healing. For other people, it can turn into like a life passion where it's like, this is what I want to do. It's like, I found my thing. And anywhere in between. But it's just, it leads to more fulfillment as a person, I think.
Yeah, we definitely have, or at least I do growing up like here, have like a lot of privilege with arts education. It's important to remember that like not everybody gets that, and that should be more widespread. Yeah. Well, that's all the questions I have. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really enjoyed it, especially having read the collection, Dear Spanish, which is so good, and you should all read it. And we're so excited for Mateo. Yeah, thank you so much.
It was an honor to feature this conversation between Mateo Acuña and Amina Mughal today. If you enjoyed listening, we welcome you to join us in person or online for our next season of events, or to check out more information about our Writers in the Schools and Youth Poetry Fellowship programs at lectures.org. Thank you to the Seattle Arts and Lectures staff, board, and community. And thanks to all of you for listening. This show would not be possible without you. Our show is produced by Jack Straw Cultural Center with theme music by Daniel Spills. To hear more, subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, rate and review us 5 stars so that more people can enjoy Sal on Air.